Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The National Institute of Justice conducted a survey of Indigenous women in the United States and learned that 4 out of 5 American Indian or Alaska Native women have been victims of violence, and over half of Native women have been victims of sexual violence. Indigenous women in the United States face murder rates that are more than 10 times the national average. Indigenous women in Canada face murder rates that are 6 times the national average there. For Indigenous people, these statistics are not surprising. They put a number on a phenomenon that has been all too real for far too long. This hour, we're going to talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women. We'll find out why Indigenous women are so often targeted historically and today, and hear the stories of survivors and victims. We'll also find out about the work that advocates and activists are doing to raise awareness of this issue. I'll talk with 3 Indigenous women who live and work in Iowa and are involved with this movement. And my first guest today is Christine Nobis. She is founder of Indigenous Iowa. She is director of the Seeding Sovereignty Shift Program. She calls herself a decolonizer. She lives in Iowa City. And Christine, I would like to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and tell me about your background as an Indigenous woman.
Hello. Thank you for having me on today, Charity. It's a pleasure. I've been listening to your show for a long time.
Oh, thank you.
It's really great to be in the studio. My name is Christine Nobis, and I'm Plains Cree Salto of the George Gordon First Nation in Saskatchewan, Canada. I grew up in Winnipeg, Canada, and I've been living in Iowa City for 14 years now. I got my master's degree here in religious studies with a focus on Native American religion and culture. And my background in this issue can be related strictly to my upbringing in Winnipeg, where the rate of missing and murdered Indigenous women exceeds numbers in other parts of the nation and is, quite frankly, it can be a dangerous place to grow up in.
Did you grow up in an Indigenous community?
I did, yes. I grew up in, I guess, well, you could, we call it the North End in Winnipeg. All my family lived there, and it wasn't the safest place to be. So my parents moved a little further out of the North End, but my ties there were significant, and I spent quite a lot of my formative years in that part of the city, which isn't necessarily the safest part of the city, but also a very culturally significant and important part where a lot of Indigenous people live.
I want to talk with you more about your identity and your experience living in Iowa a little bit later on in the program, but I would love for you to give us a broader perspective. As I said, some of these statistics that have been released from the National Institute of Justice put numbers on a phenomenon that Indigenous people have known about for a very long time. So can you try to help me characterize the problem?
The problem leads back to settler colonialism and a want to erase the people's letter here. I always tell people the definition of colonization is to go into a land base and take that land for its resources. And while doing that, you need to do something about the local population, which would include slavery, genocide, assimilation, and colonization.
And women have been particularly vulnerable historically and now. The statistics that I shared are from a survey, but to put hard numbers on this has been difficult because these aren't numbers we've been collecting.
No, and in fact, I don't agree with even numbers given out by the Department of Justice or the Office of Violence Against Women, though I know they're trying. They just don't have the data that is required to tell the truth. And if you look to grassroots organizations if you talk to people living on the reservation, some people will say that as many as 80 to 90% of women will be sexually assaulted or raped in their lifetime. I don't even, I mean, that's nearly all of us.
Right.
And so how do you account for that? And I don't even think that settler descendant society is able to even take that in yet and to feel accountable in any way for that. You know, they say that there are 5,716 women in the missing persons database as of 2016, but we all know that number is much higher because there are people that don't necessarily tell their nation when they're not at home, or there are people that aren't identified as Indigenous after the fact. And so, you know, the same thing goes for Canada as well. The numbers are much higher than we know. Always.
I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now. Tricia Ettringer is also a grassroots organizer. She works with Indigenous Iowa and lives in Sioux City. Hello, Tricia.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Tricia, I also want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I just want to say hi, Nipi. That's good morning in Ho-Chunk. My name is Tricia Ettringer, but my Ho-Chunk name is Chokshap Gwinga, which means eagle that returns. I'm a proud member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and I am of the Eagle Clan.
Tricia, tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up actually in Waterloo, Iowa. I was adopted by my auntie, and then she got divorced from her, from who she was married. So I ended up actually growing up with my father in Waterloo. However, as I got older, I found out who or where my biological parents grew up or were from. And it put me on a search to find out who my family is. And then it led me back to Sioux City, Iowa, and then around the Winnebago Reservation in Nebraska. So
you had to make an effort to go on a search to understand your identity as an Indigenous woman.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm still on that journey, too. So it's quite a process. And, you know, as Christine was mentioning, you know, with the settler colonial mindset, I was actually, you know, kind of brought up in that way, in that mindset. And then it wasn't until I got older that I recognized, oh, you know, this is how, you know, or how this happens very easily, especially when our relatives are adopted out, they kind of lose their way. So, like I said, as I got older, I got more involved. I am still learning. I don't think I'll ever not learn different things every day. So, yeah.
I want to talk about what you see going on in the Sioux City area and also in South Dakota and Nebraska, that part of the country. But can you share a personal story with me? I know that this is not just an issue for you, but you have had this happen within your family. There's a story about your aunt. Can you tell me?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is just recently. We've had stories about how one of our aunties had gone missing and we just didn't know where she was. Our family didn't have the time or the resources necessarily to track her down. But we actually have taken that task on last year, I want to say, in trying to find out what happened to her. And we located her. She was in California, and unfortunately, she had led a kind of a rock star lifestyle back then, and she fell victim to being missing and murdered. So, and we're still in the process of learning, you know, her story and what happened, and you know, and we're very fortunate to have the people that have helped us out to get to that point, because I know there's a lot of, you know, women that do go missing and murdered, and they don't, you know, they don't have those trails to, you know, kind of help find their relative that did go missing. So, and like I said, like I keep learning every day. So, when I got involved with the MMIR, which, I like to, I like to reference MMIR because it's inclusive to not just our women, but to, you know, our two-spirit, to our men and our children.
I was using missing and murdered Indigenous women. What does the R stand for?
Yeah, which is the R stands for relatives.
Okay.
So I personally like to use that one, and not to take from MMIW and, you know, and in that movement. But yeah, I'm still learning today. And like I said, this is something that I got involved with, just because, you know, I'm a woman, Indigenous woman at that. And I know that I have a target on my head, basically. Anywhere that I go, I have a target. So now it's become personal once we found out, you know, what happened to our auntie. So, yeah. So it definitely, it affects me in a different way. So
it's interesting that this was a story you didn't know and you went mm-hmm. looking for information about her.
Yep.
When you talk to other people who are members of Indigenous communities, Indigenous families, do you find that so many people have these untold stories that they didn't even know about?
Yeah, actually, it's kind of alarming. You know, like I said, we do this work, and you hear from the families and the relatives, and you know, you hear about that hurt and the pain, and there's a lot of healing that comes with that. But it's a long, hard road, and now it parallels with what we're going through. And you know, I've met some really amazing, strong women though, that, you know, kind of put it in perspective, and that have helped me along in my journey as far as healing. And I'm just getting started too, so you know, I know I'm gonna need that circle to, you know, help me get through this too. So,
well, Tricia, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Stay with us. Tricia Ettringer, a grassroots organizer for Indigenous Iowa who lives in Sioux City. Also with us, Christine Nobis. She is the founder of Indigenous Iowa. She's director of the Seeding Sovereignty Shift Program, and she lives in Iowa City. This hour, we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, and we'll find out more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women. This is a problem that awareness is growing about it, but the National Institute of Justice conducted a survey of Indigenous women and found that 4 out of 5 American Indian or Alaska Native women have been victims of violence. Over half of Native women have been victims of sexual violence. And Indigenous people in the United States and in Canada will tell you that they believe these numbers are significantly higher. These are statistics we have not been keeping track of. And really, awareness of this issue is growing right now. That's why we're talking about it this hour. And with me is Christine Nobis. She is founder of Indigenous Iowa. She's director of the Seeding Sovereignty Shift Program and a decolonizer. I can't say that very well. Tricia Ettringer is also here. She is a grassroots organizer for Indigenous Iowa who lives in Sioux City. And Tricia, just before the break, we were talking about sort of your personal awakening about this issue. But you live in Sioux City, which is an area where many Indigenous people live and pass through. Can you give me an idea of how you see this problem playing out in front of your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, this is deeply rooted in kind of colonization. You know, you have the boarding schools, you have intergenerational trauma, you have historical trauma that all play a factor into our Indigenous lives. So right now, Sioux City has problems with, or issues or problems with homelessness. We have alcoholism. We also have the meth epidemic that is kind of ruining the Sioux City community as far as like the Indigenous problems go. And not to say, you know, those are just the problems that are prominent. There are other things like suicide, you know, sexual assault. I mean, all of these all play a factor into how we kind of see ourselves as people too, as well. You know, if we don't have that support system, or if we don't have that family member to turn to and kind of figure things out for ourselves, or, you know, just that support, we can get lost along the way. So, and that's not to say, I just don't want to, you know, paint a bad picture of, you know, Indigenous communities, you know, in Sioux City, or, you know, in the surrounding area, because there's a lot of positive things that are going on too. So, but I can see how the MMIR, the MMIW, how that can play into, you know, the human trafficking, the sex trafficking. You have Omaha, which isn't that far away, and it's been alleged that Omaha is kind of the hub for sex trafficking at this point. So,
Tricia, when you started to get involved in raising consciousness of this issue, tell me about the message that you want to bring to the public, to the general public, because as I mentioned, again, these numbers aren't surprising to Indigenous people, but they are surprising to many other people. What's the message you want to make sure that you're spreading?
We are still here. We have never left. We are still here. We're still going to be here. It's time for us to be recognized, that we're here. We're not disposable. We're not, you know, just trash. And our women are just, they're so sacred. You know, we are the life givers, the, you know, the life bearers, and, you know, we should be treated as such, and not, you know, anything less of that. So my main focus is to, you know, just raise the awareness through any means possible, and to get that message out. So I've done, you know, runs, I've done marches. I've tried to include myself in any capacity that I can. So,
Tricia, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Tricia Ettringer is a grassroots organizer for Indigenous Iowa. She lives in Sioux City and is a member of the Winnebago tribe. And Christine Nobis is still with me. Christine, you have been very involved in organizing Indigenous people in the state of Iowa, in starting to do this consciousness raising. Tell me a little bit about the movement that you are a part of and that you're seeing develop around the country, because this feels like a very important time for Indigenous activism.
It is. firstly, I want to say that I'm an advocate for my sisters and brothers out there that are organizing in pockets where there is much more violence and issues around this particular crisis. This is a crisis, by the way. I just want to make that very clear. So I try to uplift the work of people that are, I like to say, in the trenches, searching, looking, you know, in these communities where this issue is very volatile. You know, Iowa, we don't have high percentages necessarily like within this state of missing people. We do have a high sex trafficking rate, by the way, just so you know. We do have women missing from the Meskwaki Nation. I just want to honor Rita Papaki at the moment, who's been missing for 4 years, I believe, and the sadness that her family has gone through. And then, of course, the rates in Sioux City, which I believe Marissa Cummings will speak about shortly. And so I just want to say that I'm very much an advocate for people in Sioux City in particular and for the work that they're doing, because I'm not there. I'm 4.5 hours away. I have spent time there with women from the Jackson Recovery Center, speaking to them specifically about, you know, what goes on. But like I said, I really want to hear from other people directly involved. That's what I do.
Yeah. And if this is part of your story, you are welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Christine, raising awareness is an important part of the work that you're doing. But that's not all you're doing. You're also working really hard to change laws and to make sure that, that Indigenous people have a voice in government. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think needs to happen legislatively to help protect Indigenous women?
Yes. First of all, I just want to mention that the Not Invisible Act that was recently drafted by Deb Haaland and another person is an important act that is going to start getting more attention. I guess you could call it an addition to Savannah's Act to beef up that act, which is still has not been passed in Congress. You know, it's being held up by Bob Goodlatte. I don't know. He's a Republican representative. And so we have issues right now with just like simple acts being passed.
And the idea behind the Not Invisible Act, tell me a little bit more about it.
The Not Invisible Act is trying to provide more, like a task force, if you will, that it would establish an advisory committee comprised of lawmakers, law enforcement, tribal leaders, and survivors to monitor this crisis and make recommendations to the Department of Justice and so forth. And it would create better practices for investigating these cases. And this would also be very community-based, and there would be hopefully an approach that involves grassroots organizers. Because that's, you know, where the information is more, in my opinion, specific. I do want to mention right now that VAWA is being held up again.
The Violence Against Women Act.
Yes, the Violence Against Women Act. And frankly, it's being held up by a domestic terrorist organization that I call that is called the NRA. I just want everybody to know the city of San Francisco Board of Supervisors just passed a resolution stating that the NRA is a domestic terrorist organization. And they're holding up the act. They're lobbying against the act because of the boyfriend loophole, so they call it. Earlier versions of VAWA prohibited possession of guns by domestic abusers, but those abusers were married or lived with or had a child with their victim. This current version that they're trying to put through provides provisions that closes the loophole where a person who is abused or, you know, shot by their partner is also put on this list of not being allowed to own a firearm. Of course, this upsets the NRA, and they are lobbying very hard right now to keep VAWA from being reauthorized.
And now the Violence Against Women Act is in effect through the end of the year. It has not been renewed.
No, it has not. It was kind of scary back in January. It was in effect back in it's going to float through since February 15th, since the government was, you know, brought back. But until we still don't know what's going on with it.
There's a part of the Violence Against Women Act that specifically affects tribal courts. And can you tell me more about that? Because it gives tribal courts the jurisdiction to prosecute non-tribal members for crimes?
It does. And that was passed in 2013 with Obama, who backed that. But it was a really difficult process because there is essentially a lack of trust by this government to have our people govern ourselves in ways that we feel necessary. And so it took quite some time for this Congress to push this amendment through. What essentially it does is it allows the tribes to prosecute non-tribal members for domestic violent crimes. It's a step in the right direction for sure, because actually this is the only legislation ever that allows that.
So there had been culturally and still is culturally and in some areas this idea that if it happens on a reservation, you can get away with it.
Yes, but you know what? That's still not good enough because it still falls into the realm of domestic violence and something that might be considered like a brief interaction or essentially rape by someone that someone doesn't know or knows briefly is still not considered to fall under this realm. And so there's still a long way to go. And also non-tribal members who are assaulted by non-tribal members can also not fall under this this realm on tribal land. So it's trying, but right. There's a lot.
Well, so. And we've talked about how so much of what has come before has made Indigenous women vulnerable today, but what I hear you saying is that we also have a legal system that reinforces that vulnerability, that makes it harder to get justice for Indigenous women.
I mean, let's be honest, this legal system was built, you know, on institutionalized racism. You know, we can talk about the Second Amendment, which is a myth that has infiltrated the core of the American imagination. They said that there's a rise in gun violence in this country right now. But it's actually a misunderstanding of history. You know, there was a period of time where maybe, you know, it wasn't as rampant, but with the rise of the NRA, and gun lobbying and mass production of automatic weapons, this long-term gun interest that Americans have is still there and coming back. It's coming back in a very scary way. America is a young country. It lacks a distinct culture. But one thing is certain, you know, Americans covet their sacred right to, you know, free real estate, cheap labor, and the gun. This country was built at the point of a gun. And I know that I'm focusing on this right now, but it's a very serious issue because 54% of mass shootings in this last decade were carried out by domestic abusers. And nearly
so you
half
feel
of
like
all
that has a very strong connection
yes,
to missing and murdered women.
And nearly half of all murdered women are killed by their romantic partners. So, you know, this also, of course, carries into our issues with missing and murdered Indigenous women. And I just feel like this is not something that we've talked a lot about in terms of MMIW, MYR, MYW, you know, MY2S, like all these. This is a part of it that needs more attention. So today I'm trying really hard to bring light to that.
Christine, you grew up in Canada in a First Nation culture. When you came to Iowa, how was it to try to find your identity as an Indigenous woman here in this state? Was that a challenge?
Yes.
Tell me more.
Well, Iowa is a very white, heavy state. I was lucky that I did a lot of work with the American Indian Student Association at the University of Iowa and found some people. But in general, it is not outside of the Meskwaki Nation or Sioux City and the Omaha Nation, which juts into Iowa, it's hard to find your people. You know,
we were talking about the not invisible act and feeling invisible in this culture is something that a lot of Indigenous people talk about. Does it feel extra invisible in Iowa?
Yes, it does. I will just be honest and say that. That's why I founded Indigenous Iowa. For that reason.
When you founded Indigenous Iowa, I can imagine that you heard from a lot of people who have felt invisible for a long time in this state. Can you tell me a little bit about bringing people together?
Yeah. There's been a good handful of people that have reached out and been like, hey, wow, I'm so happy to see this. You know, I'm not, you know, necessarily from Iowa. There's apparently, from what the statistics tell us, there are 14,000 natives living and working within this state. You know, and a majority of those people are not, you know, Meskwaki or necessarily inherently grew up here. And so it is nice to hear from people that relate and call me up or message me, and they just feel like there's something there for them. But my work with Ceding Sovereignty is where my true passion lies. And I've made a lot of great ties through that organization as well.
And we have about 30 seconds before the break, but for people who aren't familiar with Seeding Sovereignty, can you tell me just a little bit about it?
Yeah, we are an Indigenous woman-led organization. We are based out of New York, actually, New York City, Brooklyn, and here in Iowa, and in LA and New Mexico.
All right, and we'll talk more about that after the break. This hour, we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women in a movement to bring awareness to this crisis. With me, Christine Nobis. She is founder of Indigenous Iowa and director of the Seeding Sovereignty Shift Program. We'll find out a little bit more about what she does with that program in a moment. We'll also bring Marissa Cummings into the conversation as well. And you're welcome to join us with your stories, with your thoughts, with your experiences. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women. I'm going to repeat these statistics again that we have from the National Institute of Justice. They conducted a survey of Indigenous women in the U.S. and learned that 4 out of 5 American Indian or Alaska Native women have been victims of violence. Over half of Native women have been victims of sexual violence. And again, it's possible that those numbers are far higher than that as well. This is something that we don't have good statistics on, and we've been talking about partly why that is, but also this problem and why it continues to endure. With me, Christine Nobis. She is founder of Indigenous Iowa and director of the Seeding Sovereignty Shift Program. And we're going to introduce another guest in just a moment, but Christine, I had to interrupt you. I was asking a little bit about Seeding Sovereignty and the goals of that program. So again, this is a national organization led by Indigenous women. And what is the goal?
The goal is to decolonize. it's a time of climate crisis, and Seeding Sovereignty works on behalf of our global community, our global Indigenous community, to shift social and environmental paradigms. We want to dismantle colonial institutions that are based on inherent, racism or doctrine of discovery, manifest destiny ideologies, and replace them with Indigenous practices that are created in synchronicity with this land.
All right. I want to bring now Marissa Cummings into the conversation. She is also an activist and an advocate who lives in Sioux City and is a member of the Omaha tribe. Marissa, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today, and I'd also love for you to introduce yourself.
Ambate ura wangale latite ura umaha ijaje litate miakonda tisindwa ubli. Good morning, and I'm glad that you're all here, and I'm glad that we have listeners here today that are wanting to hear about the experience of Indigenous people and Indigenous women in a very productive and thoughtful way. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you. And we've talked a little bit about history. You feel like understanding the history of Indigenous people in this country is extremely important to understanding the vulnerability of Indigenous women today. Tell me more about that.
Well, first of all, I would say that we aren't a vulnerable population. We're a targeted population. And I think both Christine and Tricia have touched on that. When you look at U.S. policy and how it has existed since the Doctrine of Discovery, because that was actually written into U.S. law, you look at how Native American communities were systematically dismantled. And the goal was always assimilation or annihilation, and the goal was always access to land. And when we look at our women and the connection that our women have to the land, it makes sense that when you extract the land and the resources, you're also extracting the women.
The way that has happened historically with Indigenous women is something that it takes a long time to really understand the extent of it. I can imagine people listening and thinking, but that's historical. Why would that be part of the problem today? So connect the dots for us.
Well, I was actually born in Winnebago, Nebraska at the Indian Health Service Hospital, which is Indian Health Service is the United States treaty obligation to health service with Native American people. I was raised in Sioux City, Iowa. I lived there until I was 18 years old, where I traveled to Iowa City, Iowa. I lived there for 18 years, and then I moved home in 2012. So I have a lot of roots in Sioux City, and my reservation is 30 minutes south in Macy, Nebraska, on the border of the Winnebago, Nebraska, or the Winnebago Reservation in Nebraska. And so living in that tri-state area and being raised with aunties and grassroots activists, AIM was very popular, the American Indian Movement in Sioux City. Being raised with these women, that were, Pat Gordon is one that comes to my mind right away because she's been doing on-the-ground work since before I was born with the community. And I think about these women, and I think about women that have gone missing since the 70s in Sioux City, or women that were found murdered. And the attitude of the police department or the prosecuting attorney was always that they were less than, right? So these women, you know, we don't think we can prosecute because we're not going to win the case, even though we have physical evidence, we don't have DNA, or we don't think we have enough evidence to prosecute. And when you look into these cases, you see racism play out, and there's no other word that we can use for it. And these women are often, you know, well, they were prostitutes, or they were drinking, or there's always this victim blaming that is a part of these conversations. So we can go back historically and look at, you know, first contact with Christopher Columbus and see and read the journals where they talk about going out and looking for 9 and 10 year old girls. Or we can read the journals and look at them describe a rape of a woman. Very detailed in the journals. Or you can fast forward through the fur industry or the fur trade era when women were being trafficked into, Native women were being trafficked into trade posts. I mean, we can go back through history and look at all of these horrendous events that happen. But the reality is that we deal with those, that history is a part of us today. So in our communities, we're very much connected to our family lines. And I think Tricia talked a little bit about that and reconnecting with hers and how important that is to our spirit. And so historical trauma is a result of these generations of U.S. policy that systematically targeted Indigenous people and communities and dismantled our traditional systems that we had in place, traditional governance systems, legal systems, educational systems, societies that existed that allowed balance between men and women. And so all of that was dismantled with settler colonialism. And we know that, you know, in Sioux City, there is the highest population of Native people in the state. The last 2010 census said around 7,000 Native American people live in Sioux City, and it's a multi-tribal community. So growing up and seeing how people would say things like nits breed lice, you know, about our people. So experiencing that, you know, firsthand growing up, and then now trying to be a voice among many voices. There's a lot of people doing this work. And something that I feel very strongly about is acknowledging that this isn't about me. You know, I'm not promoting myself. I'm trying to promote the work of the spirit. And to me, that spiritual work is in helping our people and also working on ourselves and healing ourselves, because we are also the result of historical trauma. And a lot of times we carry a lot of that with us. But one thing I did want to touch on briefly is that when we talk about, and this goes historically in terms of the justice system and Native people, there's something that was called the Seven Major Crimes Act that was passed. And that Seven Major Crimes Act doesn't allow Indian communities to prosecute these, what were called seven major crimes. You're looking at murder, you know, big crimes like that, rape. And so what happened is that those seven major crimes, which is now 13 major crimes, get transferred to federal jurisdiction. So this jurisdictional issue is really messy, and I just want to explain it a little bit. So on the reservation, tribal courts do not have jurisdiction over non-Indians, period. What VAWA was allowing is tribal courts that met very high standards. So the court would actually have to apply to reach these standards where they could then prosecute a non-Indian on Indian land, but only within domestic violence situations. So that excludes, like, the trafficking, that excludes, you know, a lot of other crimes, right? So that all gets transferred to federal jurisdiction. So when it's an Indian on Indian crime on Indian lands, Native men, it goes to a federal case. And so Native men receive much stricter sentences. Whereas if it is a non-Indian man and a Indian woman on Indian land, that goes to state jurisdiction or county jurisdiction. So in our case, that's Pender. And if anyone knows about the Nebraska v. Parker case or Pender's relationship with the Omaha tribe, you know that it's a very hostile relationship. And so what happens often is those offenders are then, there's no justice. The offenders are let free. So if it's an Indian on Indian crime off the reservation, or it has the same system as it would anyone else, it goes through the county and the state. Does that make sense?
I think I'm beginning to understand it. I think that that's a big part of the problem for a lot of people in understanding how this works, Marissa, because it is so complicated and counterintuitive.
Absolutely. But VAWA did not allow for every tribe to be able to prosecute a non-Indian offender. So in my tribe's case, when this legislation came out, I actually worked for my tribe as the CTO, and we were not able to prosecute in our tribal court system because our tribal court system did not have a legally trained prosecuting attorney or a legally trained public defender. And most of the times, tribes are severely underfunded in their court system because this comes from federal money. And so tribes don't have the capacity to be able to create a court system that would then be acceptable under VAWA to prosecute non-Indian offenders.
So, Marissa, what next steps do you feel need to be taken? We've talked about the Violence Against Women Act, and there are important pieces of that puzzle. It sounds like you don't feel like that would solve the problems that we're talking about today. So what is your next step? What are you advocating for?
Well, I do think that it's a start, right? The conversation is happening, and we learn through dialogue. We learn through talking to one another and advocating. So awareness is absolutely key. It's exactly what Christine and Tricia were talking about, bringing awareness. Right now, I'm actually at the Intertribal Council of Nevada's Family Violence program that they're having, or it's a conference that they're having where they brought in several people to talk about this issue within the tribes in Nevada. And I think that I never thought I'd be doing this work, and I don't call myself an activist. I'm just an Indian woman that loves our people very, very much. And so part of that is sometimes doing the work that you didn't ever plan on really doing. And this is outside of my actual work that I do. And so connecting with other people, we're listening to Faith Spotted Eagle talk about, she has some beautiful work that she does around healing from historical trauma with Indigenous communities specifically. And that is, to me, where a lot of this starts, is that we have to heal and be able to even give voice to the trauma and abuse that we've gone through generationally. But I do just want to quickly also give a shout out to the Sovereign Bodies Institute. So when we talk about data collection and whether data is actually being recorded or not, there's always issues with they don't record race when people go missing or are murdered. So the problem is that within both on and off reservation, we're not recording race. And the other issue is that there is no federal database. The FBI does not have a database where they are collecting these numbers of our women. And so what happened is a woman named Anita Lucchesi, who is a PhD candidate in mapping, developed a database from a grassroots perspective. And I just want to give you some statistics here from her database. Approximately 4,000 cases documented in U.S. and Canada, and over half of which are murders. Over half the cases are from the U.S., 54 states and provinces, and over 450 tribal nations represented. 10% of the cases are reported as involving a sexual assault or involved victims who were reported as sex workers or victims of sex trafficking. 27% of the cases are girls, ages 18 and under. and 35% are 21 and under. 69% of the victims who were in foster care were also victims of sexual or domestic violence, and 41% of those victims experienced sex trafficking or sex work victims who are mothers are also disproportionately murdered. So I want to just give those that perspective that we're looking at also the foster care system as an avenue for many of our children that go missing and murdered. And if we look down south and what's happening at the border right now, where are those children going? And because those become very vulnerable, if you use that word, I would use targeted populations of children that get trafficked at really high rates. So that's all I wanted to say.
Marissa, it sounds like not only do you feel it's important to change laws to make it easier or possible even to prosecute in cases of Indigenous women who are victimized, but it also sounds like the just raising awareness even among Indigenous people and the spiritual healing that can take place with having stories be heard. That sounds like that's also a really important part of what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. I mean, our work primarily, we all have a space, right, in this work. A lot of our women, you can see, like, Christine's work is very specific, Trisha's work. There's a lot of other women out there doing this work in really beautiful ways, and we all have a place within that. And for me, my biggest concern is that we need to heal as a community. There's so many issues that come up because of the trauma that we have gone through generationally. And without that healing, it's really hard for us to do that work with each other in a way that is kind and productive. And so that's my love is for our people and to do that work on the ground. I have never seen the United States laws work for us. I haven't seen that happen yet. But what I have seen is women make a difference in our communities just by being themselves and having a love for our people. So it's not to say that I don't believe that those acts can't happen. I believe tribal consultation is a priority and is important. And I haven't seen that happen a whole lot with this VAWA either. You know, because these women with tribal consultation, you find out the people on the ground that are doing the work that are in the trenches. And if you're not hearing their voice, then it's just another form of colonialism. It's just another form of lateral violence.
Marissa, we are out of time. And just quickly before we go, you asked that we go out with a song called Blow Dakota Blow by Jim Page. Tell me why that's important.
Well, this is a song that I grew up with as a girl, and it's about Anna Mae Aquash, and she was the first woman that I knew that went missing and was murdered, and this was during the American Indian Movement, so it's very powerful.
Well, Marissa, thank you so much for sharing your voice with us today. Marissa Cummings lives in Sioux City. She's a member of the Omaha Tribe. Christine Nobis, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Christine Nobis, the founder of Indigenous Iowa and director of the Seeding Sovereignty Shift Program. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Enemy made a vow about the fire that night, blow the cold to blow, that she would give her life to the people's fight, and the cold winds they blow. And then the voice in the whispering wind did say, blow the cold to blow.